Okay, welcome. My name is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atid and the Web Yeshiva, and this is the very first session in our series on Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's monumental essay, The Lonely Man of Faith. I just put my email address in the chat box that you should all have it, although anybody that's gotten emails from me registered through the class already should have it, and I, of course, welcome your comments and your questions and your ongoing feedback and your own insights to what we'll be learning throughout the series. You're welcome to contact me by email, by Google Chat, or by Skype. My address for both of those is Jeffrey Sachs, JeffreySacks. For all of those different ways to contact me at Gmail or on Skype or on Google Chat. And if you're in Jerusalem or if you'll be visiting Jerusalem, you're welcome to come by to the office. I'm glad to meet with you, have a cup of coffee, and meet in person. That's always one of the great privileges and great treats that when people and I think this may be among our most geographically diverse groups so far. I think we probably have somebody in almost every time zone with us right now from the far, far west coast of Hawaii do we have New Zealand online with us? Not sure. The office is in Jerusalem right next to the president's house on Rehov HaNasi in the center of town. Like I said, we'll be studying Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay, The Lonely Man of Faith. But before we do that, I want to give a little bit of background to Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who is generally affectionately known as the Rav, the Rabbi par excellence. There are, I guess every ideological community has its own the Rav, has its own the Rabbi with a capital V. For the what's colloquially or conventionally called the modern Orthodox community, the world over, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who died in 1993, was that figure, was that monumental figure, and in some ways now almost 20 years, just marked his 18th Yahrzeit on Pesach, Passover. He still is that, very much that monumental figure. And as we go along throughout the series, I hope that will come through on how and why that is the case. Rabbi Soloveitchik was born in 1903 in a town called Pruzhan, which is today in what's known as Belarus, or White Russia. At the time he was born, it was part of Russia, of Tsarist Russia. At different points, it belonged to Poland, and it was generally part of the Lithuanian world, the world of Lithuanian Judaism. He was a descendant of a long line of very prestigious rabbis. He was named for his great-grandfather, Yosha Ber, the Beis Halevi, and he had ancestry going back to the Netziv, even really reaching back to the Vilna Gaon and even further. But for most purposes, we look to his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, of Brisk, also known affectionately as Reb Chaim, who was the great progenitor of a school of Torah study called Brisker Lumdus. The name of the town in which he served as rabbi was Brisk. Here's a map. Again, all of these borders were constantly changing. This is a contemporary map of Belarus, which is situated here to the east of Poland. Is Joel online with us? I don't see our friend in Poland, Joel Nowicki, but here's Poland, here's Lithuania, here's Latvia, here's Russia, here's the Ukraine. These are all modern, or many of them are modern. Here's Minsk, here's Pinsk, and here is what was known in Yiddish as Brisk, but is known in other languages as Brest or Brest-Litovsk or Brest on the Bug, which is the name of this river that divides Poland and Belarus. This little town, if you Google Brisk, you'll find, assuming that you can do the proper disambiguations, you'll find quite a bit of information about this little city and its Jewish heritage and the chain of rabbis that came from there. But Reb Chaim was the rabbi in Brisk. He was also on the faculty of the great Volozhin Yeshiva at a certain point, and he very much initiated what we, without overstating it, a revolution in the manner in which Torah was studied, specifically in which Gemara, in which Talmud was studied. And that mode of study which he initiated is called the Brisker Derech, or the Brisker Method, nicknamed after this town in which he was the rabbi. A very heavy emphasis on analytical study, on a heavy emphasis on Maimonides' code, the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam's code, the Mishneh Torah. This isn't a course in Brisker Lumdus, and again, with a little bit of Googling, you'll be able to find plenty of information on it. But that innovation, which was brought about by Reb Chaim, has had a very, very, very strong impact by Reb Chaim, by his students, by his descendants, a very strong impact on the world of Torah study, on yeshivot, on how Torah is studied in yeshivot. He was also known as a very sainted man, a very kind man. It was said that when he died, all he wanted written on his tombstone was Ish Chesed, man of kindness. And he was known as a community rabbi, as somebody who was a great doer of kindness. It's said that he would wake up in the middle of the night to check if anybody had left an abandoned child on his doorstep, because apparently that would happen. People who were in positions where they had to abandon children in a basket on somebody's doorstep knew that if they left them on Reb Chaim's doorstep, the child would be cared for. Reb Chaim had two sons. He had one son named Rav Yitzchak Zev, who was known by the Yiddish nickname Rav Velvel, who also bore the title of the Brisker Rav. He came to live in Israel, where he was a very prominent figure in the ultra-Orthodox world in Israel. And another son, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who left Eastern Europe to go to New York in 1929, where he became the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of Yeshiva University, which we'll talk about again in a moment. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was the father of the Rav, of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. On Rabbi Soloveitchik's maternal side, he was a descendant of the Feinstein family. His maternal grandfather was Rav Ilya Pruzhaner, because he lived in Pruzhan, which is how Rabbi Soloveitchik came to be born there. But the family name was Feinstein. That made Rabbi Soloveitchik a cousin, I believe a first cousin once removed, of Rav Moshe Feinstein, the halachic decisor, the posek, par excellence of the 20th century, who also made his way and lived on the Lower East Side in New York. The Rav's mother was a profound influence on him. In some ways, as profound as his father was, but in different ways, which I'll come back to in a moment. When Rabbi Soloveitchik was a small boy, his father was the rabbi in a town called Chaslovich. Chaslovich was a town of Chabad Hasidim, of Lubavitch Hasidim. But their custom was that they would hire a town rabbi who was a Litvak, who was not of Hasidic stock, and that's how Rav Moshe came to be the rabbi of Chaslovich, and how young Yosha Ber Soloveitchik was sent off to Cheder, to school, to Jewish school, as a young boy, where the teacher was a Chabad Chassid. And it was discovered at a certain point that he wasn't progressing in his Torah learning to satisfaction. It was actually his mother that first became alarmed by her son's progress, because in that cheder, in that school, the teacher was teaching them Tanya and other Hasidic texts instead of the proper dose of principally Gemara. And Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother alerted his grandfather, his paternal grandfather, Reb Chaim, of this alarming development. And Reb Chaim instructed his son, Rav Moshe, to take Rabbi Joseph B. out of the cheder and to learn one-on-one with him. And throughout most of his school years, as a youngster and as an adolescent, Rabbi Soloveitchik learned one-on-one with his father. And by learning, of course, we mean principally, almost exclusively, the study of Gemara. That being said, the Rav's mother was a very profound influence on the development of his mind and on his temperament. He many times would describe this in a well-renowned eulogy that he delivered for his own machatenister, his in-law, his daughter's husband's mother. He delivered a eulogy. He delivered many eulogies in his career. Many of them were written up, because often when Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was, as I'm sure many of you know, and again, I'm sure for many of you this is just a quick biographical review, and I'm sure for other people this is uncharted territory. So if it's review, bear with us. And if, on the other hand, we're going too fast, I'll send out an email, or I have sent out an email, with some supplementary links where you can fill in a little bit of your reading on the topic. When Rabbi Soloveitchik would deliver a eulogy, it was rarely the kind of eulogy that we hear today, where he talks about, you know, gives somebody's short biography. He would try to distill their personality into a typology. That use of typologies is something that we'll encounter in The Lonely Man of Faith. That character of The Lonely Man of Faith is a typology. The Ish HaHalacha, halachic man, is a typology, which may or may not correspond. These typologies may or may not correspond to actual people in the real world, but they're kind of pure personalities, distilled personalities that we can look to as different types of ideals. So in this eulogy that he gave for his in-law, for his daughter's mother-in-law, he developed this idea of Musar Avicha and Torati Mecha, that there are two different traditions, the maternal tradition and the paternal tradition. And he described the learning that he did with his father, which again was kind of conventional Jewish Gemara learning, and how that shaped his mind and how that shaped his thought and how that shaped his thinking. And he also described the Torat Imecha, the profound influence that his mother's teaching, sometimes more by example, had on his outlook, on his sensibilities, on his Jewish sensibilities, on his ability to perceive what he called God's gentle hand resting, he's speaking metaphorically, of course, resting on his young shoulders, describing the atmosphere of Shabbat. He says something, this is, I'm paraphrasing, it's not an exact quote, that he learned all of the halachot, all of the laws of Shabbat from his father, but he understood how to live Shabbat by watching his mother light the candles, daven, things of that nature. Among the ways that his mother influenced him was opening him up to and exposing him to literature and worlds of thought that were not part of the conventional Jewish studies curriculum in Chaslovich in the first decade or two of the 20th century. Both Yiddish literature and poetry, Hebrew writings, but also general literature, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and the like, that had a very profound influence on him as well, as we will unravel as we go along. In the mid-1920s, he began to pursue, never having studied in a school the way we think of it today, he began to pursue academic training, ultimately landing in 1926 in Berlin, where he attended university, pursuing a doctorate in philosophy, specifically the philosophy of the German Jewish philosopher Hermann Cohen. While in Berlin, he meets Tanya Levitt, Lewitt, who becomes his wife and his partner, and with whom he shares a deeply profound relationship throughout his life. And when she died tragically, relatively young, in the late 1960s, this left a very similarly profound impact and of sorrow and loss. In 1967, in a very short period of a couple of months, Rabbi Soloveitchik lost his mother, his brother, and his wife, all in rapid succession. And that, of course, left a lasting impact on his psyche. In 1932, fortunately, Rabbi Soloveitchik and his wife left Germany, some would say just in time, and land in Boston. His father had preceded him to America the previous a couple of years earlier in 1929. In 1932, Rabbi Soloveitchik lands in Boston, where he becomes the chief rabbi of the city of Boston. There were certain cities in the United States that had chief rabbis. It's now, I don't think that we really have that phenomena anymore. Synagogues hire rabbis. If there are two synagogues in a town, there are two different rabbis in town. But once upon a time, there was a notion that a city along the European model would have a chief rabbi. New York had only ever one chief rabbi. Other cities didn't have this. Most smaller communities didn't have such a thing. But he was the rabbi of the community of Boston, where he was responsible for all of the things that a community rabbi was responsible for. He also established a kollel, an institute of higher Jewish studies, where he tried to gather some promising young scholars to study with him at a high level. But in 1937, he and his wife, who was really one of the driving forces behind it, established the Maimonides School, which was initially an elementary school, and then later it grew into a high school as well. It's still alive and well. You can visit their website, the Maimonides School in Brookline, Massachusetts, where I think they have some information about the history of the founding of the school and Rabbi Soloveitchik's role. And he was very much involved in the establishing and the running of a day school, of a Jewish school, which provided both Jewish studies as well as, of course, general studies, with an innovation that when they began the high school, or at least the upper grades of the elementary school, they were teaching Gemara, they were teaching Talmud to the young women, to the girls as well, which today is less unconventional. But thank you, Alan, for that link. Alan's doing his job as our research assistant, posting all the good stuff into the chat box. The teaching of Gemara to girls at the time was really quite innovative, and he was an innovator in that regard. In 1941, when Rav Moshe Soloveitchik passed away, also maybe 1941, it wasn't quite so young, but he was in his early 60s. When Rav Moshe Soloveitchik passed away, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, his son, was invited to become the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University in New York. Yeshiva University, there's the one of the main buildings on the campus today. Like many of our teachers, although not all of them, I'm also a graduate of Yeshiva University, of Yeshiva College, and then later of its rabbinical school. This is the old building, what they call the old building, this Byzantine-looking structure on the corner of, you're looking now at the corner of Amsterdam Avenue and 187th Street in Upper Manhattan, in the Washington Heights section of Manhattan. This building, which was once the original building, but now is a complex of buildings on the campus. Here's the library, which must have been built in the 60s. This building was built in the 1920s, I believe. This housed for many years the main Beit Midrash, the main study hall of the yeshiva. Today, it's the high school. There's an affiliated high school of Yeshiva University, which is housed here, and they have other classrooms and a dormitory and things like that. So in 1941, Rabbi Soloveitchik was invited to replace his father. And in what must have been a very unconventional mode back then, he accepted the position, but he did not leave Boston. And from 1941 until he stopped teaching because of ill health in 1986, he commuted back and forth every week. He would come down by train, later by plane, to New York in the beginning of the week. He would stay over 3 or 4 nights in New York and go back to Boston, where he fulfilled all of his responsibilities in the community, in the school, and certainly on Shabbat and holidays in Boston. And he kept up this commute for over 45 years, which again in the 1940s must have been incredibly remarkable for somebody to be doing this. Nowadays it's less noteworthy. We have people here in Israel who work in America and travel back and forth every week. But back then, it was really, I think, something quite unusual. He takes over for his father in 1941. He also, at different periods, is teaching more academic studies beyond the conventional yeshiva studies in the rabbinical school, where he was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head teacher. Even though when he was appointed, he was quite young. He was younger than most of the other teachers on the rabbinical faculty, but he was recognized as head and shoulders above others. Pesach Rogoway points out that in the days, I guess, before you had to go through all the security you do now to travel from one airport to another, he would often travel Soloveitchik, being a kind of tongue twister for most people. His plane ticket would often be issued, instead of to Joseph Soloveitchik or Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, it was issued under the name Joe Solo. Anyway, we could, the anecdotes about Rabbi Soloveitchik, some of which are actually true, could occupy a whole semester, but we're not gonna go there. In addition to teaching on the rabbinical faculty, he also taught philosophy, or Jewish philosophy, specifically in the graduate school of Jewish studies. What are these chats? Okay. Alan's posted a link, I think, must be to his biography or something on the Yeshiva University site. Among the interesting phenomena, thoughts and ideas and trends in his thought that emerged over his career were what's known under the slogan, at least in YU, as Torah Umada. Torah Umada, let me just write it up here on the board. The slogan of Yeshiva University is Torah Umada, which might be translated as Torah and general wisdom, or Torah and science, or Torah and general or secular studies. It's not a topic that Rabbi Soloveitchik actually ever addressed head on. The phrase, the slogan, Torah Umada, is probably one that he never uttered, certainly not in any way to give a full-blown exposition of a philosophy. But he was very much engaged with the world of general studies. Philosophy, as well as the sciences, the philosophy of science in particular, and in literature, in the sciences, these were all things that interested him, things that he was knowledgeable about, and things that he spent some time trying to explicate a sense of the relationship between Jewish life and learning and general studies. And this comes through very clearly in his philosophical writings. In his conventional Torah scholarship, in his teaching, less frequently his writing on halachic topics, on Gemara, on things, it's a little less apparent, but in his writings and in his speaking, he spoke in many different venues. He spoke to Jewish audiences, he spoke to general audiences, he spoke in secular universities from time to time. The essay that we'll be studying together had its original germ, the original presentation of those ideas were delivered in such a forum. This idea that general wisdom and philosophy and literature and science can inform the Torah personality and can relate to our principle, the meat and potatoes of Torah study, was very innovative, and even today is something of an innovation. Even though he never mapped out a pedagogical plan for how the two sides of the curriculum relate to each other, And that was one of the hallmarks of his religious worldview. He provided very profound intellectual leadership for the Orthodox community in the United States throughout the 20th century, although not in the way that we often think of great rabbis. Like I mentioned, not in the realm of psak halacha per se, although if somebody asked him a question, he would answer. And certainly in his role as community rabbi in Boston, he did play that role, but his leadership was more principally in the realm of public policy. So, for example, questions of interfaith relations, which were a topic of great moment, particularly in the 1950s and 60s. He had a very strong sense of what interfaith relationships should be like. And in an essay entitled Confrontation, which I think you can access online, I'll send out the link, he outlines in what ways are all people of faiths, Jewish, Christian, Catholic, in those days there wasn't much conversation about Islam. Thank you, Alan. There you go. In what ways we are all partners as people of faith in trying to advance certain causes in the world, and in what ways each faith community is unique and stands alone and has its own integrity, which cannot be breached and cannot be a partner to the kind of conversation and dialogue that often passes for interfaith relations. That was a public policy role. He was also well known in deviation from what he pointed out was his long family tradition as embracing Zionism, embracing religious Zionism. Although there was nothing whatsoever messianic in his Zionist thought, he could not help but recognizing that the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 was what he called the most significant event in modern Jewish history. And that it provided us an opportunity as a people that we didn't have. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a great fan of creativity, of initiative. I one imagines that it would not have been lost on him that the Jews returning to their own state and the experiment of creating a Jewish state with all of the problems that faced us in 1948, that still face us in 2011, in trying to get it right, in trying to run a state, in trying to create a Jewish state, in trying to even think about the question of what does it mean to have a Jewish state, that the excitement of that experiment was something that was appealing to him. That being said, in America he was the head of the Mizrahi, of the religious Zionist movement in America. He delivered a yearly address at their conference. These number of times a year he would give these large public addresses, which would be attended by hundreds, by thousands. He would speak in most cases in Yiddish. He was a fantastic orator in Yiddish, Hebrew, or English, but particularly in his native tongue of Yiddish. Those addresses would often be written up. There's a collection in Hebrew called Chamesh Drashot. In English, it's called The Rav Speaks. It's a collection of his essays or his addresses to the Conference of the Religious Zionists in America about Zionism, about the State of Israel. They were delivered throughout the, I think most of them were delivered in the 1950s. In the early 1950s, he delivered an address which was later written up and published as Kol Dodi Dofake. It's been translated at least twice as the voice of my beloved Knox. It's a quote from Shir HaShirim, which is a profound, sweeping analysis of religious Zionism, of the opportunities afforded by the establishment of the State of Israel. And anybody that's interested in that is certainly recommended to read that very moving essay. That being said, most of his teaching was done orally. There are many recordings of his speeches. I'll send you some samples, links to some of them. He, in English, he spoke with a somewhat heavy European accent, which to the untrained ear takes a little getting used to. But he didn't write very, very much. Most of the writings that we have today, most of the books, if you look on Amazon under Soloveitchik, you'll see numerous books in English. Most of the books that we have of his are collections of essays that are transcripts or edited transcripts of talks that he gave. In many occasions, in many of the books that we have, they were transcripts that others prepared that he didn't even necessarily review, or things that were done posthumously. And very few of his publications were written as publications prepared by him for publication. The two most significant works that I would draw to your attention are The Lonely Man of Faith, which we will be studying together, which, although, like all of his writings, I'm sure, originated as talks and addresses to different groups before he, you know, while he was formulating the ideas, and then he writes it down. And The Lonely Man of Faith was written down by him in English. The text that we will be studying was the text written by him in English, not translated into English, but the actual thing. The other, perhaps most important work, is a volume called Halachic Man, which was written by him in Hebrew, called the Ish Halacha in the 1940s, and then only in the 1980s translated back to English under his direction, as Halachic Man. Alan, I think, has just put up a link to, Rafi has put up a link to a collection of these writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik that have come out posthumously by the foundation that was set up by his family. And these are, publications, I think there's about 10 volumes. Oh, I see the page that's up there from Ketav are both books by Rabbi Soloveitchik and books about Rabbi Soloveitchik. But the books that all look the same, that all look like they're part of a series, are either transcripts of talks or manuscripts that he had prepared but did not publish in his lifetime. But all of these have been published posthumously. Isha Halacha, Halachic Man, is an analysis of one of these typological characters. He claims that the description fits that of his father, grandfather, and uncle. It's possible that it doesn't even describe him himself. It's possible that he even had something of a gentle critique on the Isha Halacha. That's a different topic. but I've addressed it in some of my writings, which I sent you links to. In this work, Halachic Man, he sets up three characters. One is cognitive man, the scientist. One is what he calls by the Latin term homo religiosus, religious man. And standing above both of them is halachic man. Now, it's important to point out for here and throughout the series, when Rabbi Soloveitchik uses the term halacha, when Rabbi Soloveitchik, our friends are posting fast and furious links to some of the many, just the tip of the iceberg of the resources that are out there of Rabbi Soloveitchik's publications and Divrei Torah and books about Rabbi Soloveitchik and recordings, etc. So everyone's welcome to examine them through the links in the chat or to do your own Googling. When Rabbi Soloveitchik uses the term halacha, so there's halacha with a capital H and there's halacha with a lowercase h. When we use the term halacha, you know, in everyday speech, we use it as a synonym for law. Like someone might ask, a sukkah that only has two walls, what's the halacha? Meaning, what's the law? What's the din? What's the Jewish regulation in such a case? But there's also halacha with a capital H. And Rabbi Soloveitchik uses the term halacha as a synonym even for Judaism. You know, sometimes people will say, well, the Torah says X, Y, and Z. And you can look all day from today until tomorrow for the verse in the Torah that says that. And there is no such verse. There is no such pasuk. So what did the person mean when they said the Torah says? So they weren't meaning the Torah to mean the five books of Moses, the Chumash. They were using the term Torah as a synonym for the Jewish worldview. They were trying to distill what the Torah means or what they think the Torah means. So for Rabbi Soloveitchik, halacha, Jewish thought and law combined, is the distillation of what the Torah wants, really what God wants. And so sometimes, or in most cases, when he uses the term halacha, he doesn't mean it in the narrow sense of law, but he means it in the grandiose sense of the entirety of the whole system. So halachic man means the Jewish worldview, the Torah's worldview. So he sets out here, and this was written 25 years before The Lonely Man of Faith, which we'll be studying. But it's such an essential introduction to his worldview and to his thought that it's worth our time to take this detour through the halachic man so that we can get to the lonely man of faith. Without going into it too much, the halachic man is probably a description of Rabbi Soloveitchik's forebears, who lived in the pre-modern world, who lived in the world of Brisk and of Chaslovich and of Volozhin, of Eastern Europe. The lonely man of faith, the character that we will meet in our reading of the essay by that same name, is a man who lives in the modern world, in the world of the 20th century, in the world which has secular surroundings, and is probably more a description of Rabbi Soloveitchik's own spiritual inner biography. I'll add an asterisk to the end of that sentence because it's an oversimplification. Here at the very beginning of this essay, Halachic Man, let me just make it a little bigger. He says, here, let me just go up. He set out these two other characters, cognitive man and religious man, the scientist and the generally understood religious personality. He says, halachic man, who stands above both of them, imagine a triangle, halachic man is not some illegitimate, unstable hybrid. On the contrary, out of the contradictions and antinomies, there emerges a radiant, holy personality, whose soul has been purified in the furnace of struggle and opposition, and redeemed in the fires of the torments of spiritual disharmony to a degree unmatched by the homo religiosus. The halachic man is torn between both, and he emerges above the fray. Lefum tzara agra, says the Mishnah in Avot, in accordance with the suffering, with the struggle, is the reward. Since halachic man has to synthesize, has to transcend different poles, he grows, he elevates himself through that struggle. There is much truth to the fundamental contention set forth both by the dialectical philosophies of Heraclitus and Hegel. Heraclitus was the Greek philosopher, you know, who said that, he also said that you can never step into the same river twice, you know, because everything is always in a state of flux. But in this regard, he said that everything comes about through struggle, that growth comes about through struggle. Hegel, the German philosopher, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, that with regard to the ongoing course of existence in general, the views of Kierkegaard, Karl Barth, Rudolf Otto, the great existential philosophers who had such a profound impact on him. If any of these figures are wholly unknown to you, a quick trip to Wikipedia will fill in a lot of the gaps about existential philosophy. There is a creative power embedded within antithesis. And again, like I said, creativity for Rabbi Soloveitchik is an essential, if not the essential, human imperative. The entire second half, the larger half of Halachic Man, is dedicated to Halachic Man's creative capacity. Now, by creative, he's not talking about what we think of as creative, you know, in the kind of, you know, we want a kid to be able to play the trumpet and also draw a picture. And we talk about creativity in those terms. He's talking about creativity principally on an intellectual plane, on a conceptual plane. There is creative power embedded within antithesis. Conflict enriches existence. The negation is construction. And contradiction deepens and expands the ultimate destiny of both man and the world. Now, here in footnote, in this footnote, the long footnote 4, the fourth footnote runs on for, I don't know, about 5 pages, and is an essay in and of itself. In this footnote, which we can't read all of together, but you're welcome to make your way through it on its own. Hold on. Let me get it up on the screen. You got it? He says, he's talking about the view which is prevalent contemporary religious circles. Now again, this is being written in the 1940s. And what he's saying, in some ways, still true for today, in some ways even more true today, but it's situated in a type of polemic, which is definitely less true today. And don't be offended by what he has to say, because we must understand that it was a time when American Protestantism and the Reform and conservative movements in America posed a type of threat to Orthodox Judaism. That the relationship between the movements and the religions today is really quite different. But independent of the particular sociological realities in which this debate is taking place, the truths of what he's trying to articulate about Orthodox Judaism still holds true. It is, of course, important to remember that in the 1940s, the best predictions of every sociologist were that within a generation, Orthodox Judaism would be a museum piece. It just simply would not exist. And that was not an implausible prediction from the objective point of view of sociology. It didn't really look like orthodoxy of any stripe, right-wing orthodoxy, centrist orthodoxy, modern orthodoxy, was going to really have much of a future. But of course, it has. So he says that the prevalent point of view about religious experience, the prevalent nowadays in religious circles, whether in Protestant groups in America or in American Reform and Conservative Judaism, that the religious experience is a very simple nature. That is, devoid of the spiritual tortuousness present in the secular cultural consciousness, of psychic upheavals, and the pangs and torments that are inextricably connected with the development and refinement of man's spiritual personality. This popular ideology contends that the religious experience is tranquil and neatly ordered, tender and delicate. Later he'll talk about the idea of green pastures, still waters, that religion is something that solves all of your problems, that helps you sleep easy at night, gives you all the answers. Perhaps not in the 1940s, but later in the 1960s, the idea that religion creates family stability, the family that prays together stays together, that religion is some kind of panacea for every social ill that we can ever imagine, from divorce to drug abuse to anything else. That religion is an enchanted stream for embittered souls and still waters for troubled spirits. He rejects this idea. He rejects it with two hands. He has a claim that the ideology is partially embedded in the most ancient strata of Christianity, that the idea that religion is an escape from the turbulence of life to a magical, still and quiet island where one can devote oneself to the ideal of naturalness and vitality, that it's a kind of, hold on, let me fix the screen, a poetic Arcadia, a kind of Garden of Eden, of simplicity, wholeness, and tranquility. If you wish to acquire tranquility, I'm skipping ahead here. If you wish to acquire tranquility without paying the price of spiritual agonies, turn unto religion. If you wish to achieve a fine psychic equilibrium without having to first undergo slow, gradual personal development, turn unto religion. He's quoting the conventional point of view, which he's rejecting. If you wish to achieve an instant spiritual wholeness, turn unto religion. Simplicity that need not be forged out of the struggles and torments of consciousness, turn unto religion. That's what religion is selling you in mid-20th century. It would appear to me that there is no need to explain the self-evident falsity of this ideology. The entire romantic aspiration to escape from the domain of knowledge, the rebellion against the authority of objective scientific cognition, which has found its expression in certain current philosophies, have brought complete chaos and human depravity. To the world, and let the events of the present era be proof, World War II, that this idea that religion is bliss and tranquility and has turned away from the cognitive act, has turned away from science, has been very damaging. Now, this is, of course, very interesting. And it's indicative of Rabbi Soloveitchik's. I know it's a moment past 11, but give us just a couple more minutes so we can conclude here. The confidence to say that we have nothing to fear, that religion, that Judaism has nothing to fear from science, the ongoing, it's sometimes shocking, ongoing debate between science and religion is something that's not threatening to him, and neither should it be threatening to us. We are, after all, Judaism is, after all, not, we are not evangelical Christians. We are not, we do not read the Bible literally. This is not our tradition. It's, on the contrary, it's quite shocking to me that there are people within our tradition that do adopt these notions. We are the ones that invented the idea that the Bible can't be read literally. It has to be read as part of an interpretive tradition. It has to be read with an oral tradition that explains what the words mean. It's not what he's talking about here, but it's part of the same. It's part of the same worldview. Which is that we have nothing to fear, and on the contrary, fearing cognition, fearing scientific objectivity, rebelling against it, ultimately erodes religion and undermines religion's purpose in the world. The individual who frees himself from the rational principle and who casts off the yoke of objective thought will in the end turn destructive and lay waste the entire created order. Therefore, it's preferable that religion should ally itself with the forces of clear logical cognition, as uniquely exemplified in the scientific method. Even though at times the two might clash with one another, rather than pledge its troth to be beclouded, mysterious ideologies... Hold on. Mysterious ideologies that grope in the dark corners of existence, unaided by the shining light of objective knowledge, and believe that they have penetrated to the secret core of the world. Second, this ideology, the ideology that religion is all about, you know, being happy, is intrinsically false and deceptive. That religious consciousness in man's experience, which is most profound and most elevated, which penetrates to the very depths and ascends to the very heights, is not that simple and comfortable. On the contrary, it's exceptionally complex, rigorous, torturous. Again, I'll leave it to you to finish reading the next bit. Let me just quote one more piece. Here, And again, remember, all of this is a footnote. Religion is not at the outset a refuge of grace and mercy for the despondent and desperate, an enchanted stream for crushed spirits, but a raging, clamorous torrent of man's consciousness, with all its crises, pangs, and torments. Religion, in other words, is not the thing that gives you all the answers. It is the thing which gives you all the questions that keeps you up at night searching for answers. The other remarkable element of all of this is a religious philosophy which is almost exclusively focused not on God, but on man. It's less, I mean, it's, others have said, it's less theology than religious anthropology. It's a study of man. So that in that essay, for example, Koldo Dido Fake, which is about the rise of the State of Israel and religious Zionism, but actually begins with a discussion of the Holocaust. It's written just a few years after the Holocaust and opens with a discussion of Eov, of the book of Job, and suffering. He takes the whole question of theodicy, the whole question of why the righteous should suffer, why the innocent should be punished, one of the most complicated, profound religious questions, and he turns it on its head. And he says it's not a question about God, but a question about man. It's a question of when you're faced with human suffering, not why would God do that. Ultimately, that is a spiritually distracting question. Because what you should be asking yourself is, what is my role in the world in the face of suffering? What is my role in trying to be an alleviator of suffering? Ultimately, questions about how God runs the world are unknown to us. All we are faced with is our actions in this world and how we can serve as agents of repair and reconstruction and return and renewal and fixing and tikkun and etc. Though those are terms that he didn't use, but I think that's the tenor of what he says. It's a completely radical reorientation of the whole question, where it becomes not a question about God, but a question about man, because that's ultimately what interests him. That's ultimately what interests him is the question of the religious person. Here in Ish Halacha. And next week we will see in The Lonely Man of Faith, which is predicated on very different circumstances. I sent out a link to a little symposium that I had edited a number of years ago to commemorate the 40th anniversary of The Lonely Man of Faith, which was first published in 1965. So this must have been about 6 years ago. And in the little piece that I wrote there, I mentioned that, you know, many people come to The Lonely Man of Faith by mistake. I did as an adolescent, assuming that it meant, you know, kind of like a guide to the perplexed, faith, you know, how do you believe? How do you know there's a God? Those kinds of questions. It's not about that at all. It's about the integrity of being a person of faith and the challenge, the viability of being a person of faith in a world where that is no longer a given. And again, it's not an essay about questions of God, questions the way we generally think of questions of faith. It's a question of fidelity, how one remains a person of fidelity, of commitment, of truth in a world where those are not the spiritual conditions which make up the woof and warp of the world in which we necessarily live. That's a world I think that most of us occupy today, whether we live here in Israel or we live abroad. We are all moderns now. We are all living in the modern world, whether we're aware of it or not sometimes. And that's the question that will occupy us in A Lonely Man of Faith. So I'd like for you for next time, if you can read through, there's a short preface, one or two pages, and the first chapter, or at least the first half of the first chapter. I'm going to send you a link now where you can get the book. I have already sent you. You can buy the book. I certainly recommend that you buy a copy of the book. But there is a copyright permission version of the book available online, and you can print it out as a PDF. Or you can read it online. There are also, of course, ebook versions of The Lonely Man of Faith for Kindle and Nook and all those other fancy things that I don't have, but I'm guessing some of you do. I sent out those links previously, or you can get them again from the website. And for next week, if possible, to read through the end of the first chapter. But before you do that, to look at chapters 1 and 2 of Bereshit, of Genesis, which have these two different accounts of the creation of man. And that becomes the crux around which The Lonely Man of Faith is built. The differences between those two chapters, the two different accounts of the creation of man, become again two typologies of man's different roles, and the dialectic between those roles and the way in which we can bridge those two different imperatives on us become the theme of The Lonely Man of Faith. So I'll send you an email with all of those links, and of course I welcome you, your comments, your questions, your feedback, your input as we move along. I will stay online for a few minutes if anybody has any questions.